Welcome to the Book Show, heard coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. I'm Alex Papajohn.
And I'm Jack Singer.
This is Cutting Edge Talk about cutting edge books. And we're broadcasting in our new studio high atop the Westwood Building in Richmond, Virginia, with a commanding view of the parking deck. This evening, we're going to be talking to Kenneth W. Starr, Ken Starr, who is most famously known for his role as independent counsel in the Whitewater Affair, of which the Monica Lewinsky episode was an offshoot. We're going to talk to Mr. Starr about his book, First Among Equals, The Supreme Court in American Life. We're going to talk about some contentious issues the court has wrestled with, and perhaps some about Whitewater and Bill Clinton.
Exactly. I think the biggest issues most people have, they wanted more juicy information, which, while the book is great, don't get me wrong, it doesn't go into the
salacious details?
That's the word for it.
Yeah, they were salacious at that. All right. Well, coming up today on the book show, we're going to have a What's News in Publishing this week with author, journalist, and e-publishing guru M.J. Rose out of New York. If you're interested in any of M.J. Rose's books, by the way, and her latest is Flesh Tones, go to www.mjrose.com. And I believe this week we're going to forego our top 10 best-selling books in America because we have such...
Right, and same with the contest section. You can still get the contest information simply by going to our website. It is still there at www.thebookshow.com. We're just not going to have it on live because we're trying to spend as much time as we can with Ken Starr.
That's right. And for those of you who are new listeners to the book show, what is the book show about? The show is about books and the people that write them. Our slogan is Cutting Edge Talk about cutting edge books. We like to talk to authors who have written books on hot topics, timely issues, provocative and controversial subjects, fiction and nonfiction. We do it all. This is going to be a nonfiction book tonight.
Yes.
And
although the liberals would say it's fiction.
Actually, this morning. That's right. The liberals might say it's fiction. Ken Starr, by the way, is known to be conservative.
Right. He tries to give a balanced opinion, but he does tend to be conservative.
That's right. Well, all right. I think we're going to...
Let's get MJ on the line.
Yeah, we're going to get MJ on the line.
MJ.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
MJ, welcome to the book show. We're broadcasting from our brand new customized studio.
How savvy.
Yeah, and our new offices high atop the Westwood Building with a commanding view of
the parking lot.
Is this your own studio?
It's our own studio.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, the book show has its own studio. Well, we're excited to have you. Hope you had a nice holiday.
Yes, I did. Did you?
Good. It was good.
Yes, very nice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why don't we get to your news items?
Okay.
What's happening in the publishing world? And first, we have an article here, which is somewhat pessimistic, I guess, on the view of the long-term prospects for the book industry.
Yeah, totally pessimistic. I was very depressed reading this article. All the numbers are down. All the indicators are bad. Looking at the last 6 years in publishing, Let's see, some of the first numbers are consumer spending on books rose 16%, but unit sales dropped 6%, which means readers laid out more money for books, but they bought fewer of them.
Well, maybe the books are just longer now.
No, the books are just more expensive now.
Okay.
So that's the first one.
Right.
And then the number of households buying at least one book per year, which really isn't a lot.
No, not at all.
Has dropped steadily over the last 5 years, falling from 60% to 56.5%.
Mm. That's amazing.
So, that's bad.
When I look at my house, and if I have to count how many books we go through in our house, my gosh, it's probably 50, 60, it could be 100 books in a year in our house.
I know.
Well, you guys are avid readers. I have a couple of theories, though.
Wow.
First of all, people are working more. They're working longer hours than they did even 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps people just don't have as much time to read books anymore.
I think it's the other media outlets, the TV and the internet and stuff
I think online reading is also up as well.
Yeah, I agree that it's not just working harder. I think it's the talent. I think we've talked about this before. I think it's easier to be entertained in other media. Reading is harder. It takes more concentration. It's not passive. Television, movies, renting movies, watching DVDs, it's all very passive activity.
Mm-hmm. But what about audiobooks? Does this study take into account audiobooks?
No, this is just about hardcover. Hardcover, paperback, and I guess trade paperback.
See, I think audiobooks are primarily used for people in cars. I mean, I wouldn't sit in my house and listen to an audiobook. I'd much rather be entertained by TV or read a book myself than
listen to it. No, as a matter of fact, I did that for a while, and the man that I live with went insane every time he walked into the room, and I had the headphones on.
Yeah.
He said it was like I was on another planet, and I couldn't be reached.
Okay. Well, if this article is right, and the future of the book industry is looking...
Newspapers have also gone down dramatically,
well,
too.
Sure,
same thing.
Sure, they have. Is there a remedy? Is there something we can do to encourage more, especially young people, to read? Be innovative, perhaps? Creative programs?
Oh, you know, here I go. I think all they have to do to get people to read is to make do some more advertising and marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at the advertising that the book industry does for books in general, that get caught reading thing,
right?
It's so silly. I mean, if there were more contests, if there were more reasons that people were given for reading, if the campaign about reading talked to, over the course of a year, 24 people who talked about the book that changed their life, and how it changed their life, and you made books as inspirational as you make movie advertising or music advertising, I think that you'd see more people picking up books.
Right.
When Oprah talked about a book, people bought it. Oh, I should say something else. Those statistics, Oprah's book show, I mean, this is weird, but Oprah's book club was doing one book a month. Up until 2001. And every time she picked a book, it sold a million copies. She went down from 12 a year to like 6 a year in 2001. So a lot of those millions of books that weren't sold, I believe, were also because Oprah started winding down the book club.
That's amazing that one person could have such an influence.
Yeah. I mean, she was responsible for selling 12 to 18 million books a year.
Well, now we have a lot of alternatives. You know, we have the Today Show.
Not like Oprah.
Good Morning America.
Yeah, but they each maybe sell 100,000 copies, if that. Even all together, they don't come up to her numbers. Because she was like having a friend tell you about a book she loved.
Right.
And these are much more obvious entertainment.
Right.
You know.
Well, then maybe we need... You know, more entertainers and Hollywood types who are willing to take an interest and promote books.
Yeah, you need more TV shows that have characters reading the books. You know, when The Sopranos had Carmella reading the Geisha, what was it called? The Geisha book. Anyway, I can't think of the name. But when they had her reading this one book, the sales of the book went through the roof.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I have the cookbook, The Sopranos.
Oh, do you?
Cookbook. Yeah. Well, we interviewed the author.
Oh, yeah. I love The Sopranos.
Well, all right. Let's keep our fingers crossed that things look better.
Yes. We're doing our part.
Yes, you are.
That's right. Second news item concerns some prison inmates who had their essays collected into an autobiographical collection, and it's being sold, and now there's a controversy as to whether the inmates ought to get paid.
Right.
For their
work. The person, Wally Lamb, who's a pretty famous author, speaking of Oprah, she picked both of his books. She's Come Undone was the first one, and the second one was This Much Is True. And Wally Lamb teaches in Connecticut at a university here, and he also teaches a creative writing class in a women's prison. And so it's the essays that he taught from the class that he taught. And what happened was that a lot of people are protesting that these stories are going to be sold. HarperCollins is the publisher.
Right.
And a lot of people are complaining.
Well, if the stories are not about the specific crime, people shouldn't have a complaint if they're writing about their experience in prison or something like that.
It's just what's going to happen with the money. I agree with you. I just thought it was interesting because it always comes up every once in a while, you know, prisoners making money from while they're in prison.
Mm-hmm. All right, third news item is about a book that was written by a National Book Award winner, right? Julia Glass?
Yeah, it was the surprise winner last year. The National Book Award was given in November, and the surprise winner was Three Junes by Julia Glass, first-time novelist at 46, with a really heartbreaking story. I mean, she's had breast cancer, and it's recurred. She's got two kids and a husband, and she won this award in amazingly prestigious, probably the most prestigious award for a novel in America. And New York Magazine just did an article, and I have no argument that the woman is very brave because of her illness and that she's a good writer. But what's really getting writers everywhere incensed is that her editor at Pantheon, Deb Garrison, says, "Julia is incredibly brave. To be a first novelist in your 40s, writing without a book contract and no steady income, to just say, this is what I have to be doing."
Yeah.
And writers everywhere are incensed. First of all, any writer who's published really only has the income from the book that's being published, unless you have a two-book deal, but then you only have the income from two books. After the two books, you got to go renegotiate, resell. Look, thousands of writers every year are dropped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Second of all, 80,000 people self-publish their novels a year, and 130,000 books, not just novels, are published a year. So I'm, and a lot of writers, are very confused about what's so brave about writing a book.
It was just marketing promotion, I guess.
No, it was really, the editor really felt this, and the article went on about it in depth.
Really?
Yeah, that when you're in your 40s to take on a novel is an amazing thing to do.
Those old people in their 40s, huh?
Really? I think it's braver to write a novel when you're 18 because everybody's going to laugh at you because you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Hey, I have my 10-year-old girl. I have her writing now. I'm getting her started early.
Well, I didn't include this in the news, but there was a huge sale last week. A teenager, I think he's 19, had self-published the first book of what would be a trilogy, along the lines of Lord of the Rings.
I have it right here.
Uh-huh.
Christopher Paolini.
Right.
18-year-old. I was going to talk about it in case we...
$500,000 contract.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
$500,000. A friend of mine did it. Simon Lipscar at Writer's House was the agent. $500,000 contract. 18 years old. Three books.
And he's the guy who got self-published initially.
Yep.
Factsource.com. I think it's a publishing business run by his parents.
It is. Isn't that great?
Sure it is.
Great
awesome.
Story.
It is. It's like an entrepreneur there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us this week, MJ.
Thank you for having
Appreciate
me.
Appreciate it. All right. We'll see you next week. That's MJ Rose, author and journalist and e-publishing guru out of New York. By the way, if you're interested in any of her works, you can go to www.mjrose.com. This is The Book Show, Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to have Ken Starr, author of First Among Equals, The Supreme Court in American Life.
Be right back.
Hey, Billy, what you doing on the computer?
I'm playing Caveman. It's really cool.
It may be cool, but it's just a game. Come with me.
Where are we going?
You'll see.
Wow, Luray Caverns! A real cave!
Now you can really play Caveman.
Hey, fried eggs! Did cavemen eat fried eggs?
Probably not.
And look, a pool!
You know, nothing beats a day at Luray Caverns. Formed over 400 million years ago, it's filled with wondrous things. There's even a real pipe organ here we call our stalactite organ that actually uses real stalactites to form the tones. And then there's the... well, you'll just have to come see it for yourself.
See? You learned something.
I sure did. What'd I learn?
You learned that computers are great, but nothing beats the real thing.
Right. So come on, everybody.
Be a caveman!
Do you want thousands of books at your fingertips? If so, go to eNovel.com. At eNovel.com, you'll find thousands of e-books, print books, and audiobooks to browse and buy. eNovel.com, the world's biggest e-book site, sells books from big-name authors and hot new rising stars. And if you're a promising writer, eNovel might publish your book, too. So go to www.enovel.com to shop for great e-books, print books, and audiobooks, or to publish your own book today.
The world of publishing is changing. More and more authors are self-publishing their work, and why shouldn't they? Self-publishing offers greater creative control and potential for greater financial reward than more traditional methods. That's why we started Self-Publishers Digest, a how-to guide for authors that want to publish their own work successfully. Each month, we feature articles about writing, marketing, and promoting your self-published piece. All of the articles are written by authors who have self-published successfully. If you're interested in learning more about the world of self-publishing or submitting a story, please contact us at info@titanbeach.com. Or, if you're interested in display or classified advertising opportunities with Self-Publishers Digest, please contact Chris Ferguson at cferguson@titanbeach.com. Self-Publishers Digest, the path to self-publishing. Hi, Mr. Starr.
Yes.
Hey, Alex Papajohn with The Book Show.
Alex, how are you?
Great, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for being flexible.
Hey, well, I appreciate you being flexible. I'll tell you, we have a brand new studio, customized radio studio, and you literally are the very first person.
Except for the technician.
Yeah, except for the technician that's going to be using this system and being interviewed on it. So you're going to have to bear with us because there is a theoretical possibility that we interview you and something happens during the middle of the interview. And by the way, it's all taped, so we can screw up all we want.
Okay.
It doesn't matter. But I just wanted to forewarn you that we have a lot of new equipment here and we've been working like the Dickens to get it working right, but there is a possibility that we might have a malfunction.
And if it does, we'll just call you right back. This is Jack Singer, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah. If there's something wrong, we'll give you a buzz right
all
back.
All right.
Now, if you'll just hold on for a moment, I'm going to hit
that
a button and
it will be live.
Yeah, live as in we'll be
recording.
Taping the interview.
Right.
All right. So hold on just one moment.
Okay. Can you still hear us okay?
Yes. You're sounding a little bit fuzzy.
Okay, I apologize for that. And if it gets too bad, let us know, and we can always redo this.
Okay.
All right, well, welcome to the book show. And we have on the book here, it says Kenneth W. Starr. Can we just call you Ken?
Absolutely.
All right, fantastic. I'm Alex Papajohn, and Jack is the other co-host. We both just finished your book, and I really enjoyed it very much. I happen to be an attorney myself. I'm certainly not a constitutional scholar, and it's been a number of years since I went to law school, but I really enjoyed your book.
Well, thank you, Alex.
And I'll tell you what, it was written very, very clearly and succinctly. One of the things
plain English.
Yeah, plain English, exactly.
Well, thank you. That was part of the goal.
Right, because I am not an attorney. I'm more of an accountant slash computer geek, and I even understood it.
Good.
Why don't we start off... Could you just give us a brief background on yourself, Ken?
Yes, I grew up in the great state of Texas and graduated from college in Washington, D.C., at George Washington University, spent a year in graduate school at Brown University in Rhode Island, then worked as a contract officer for the State Department for a year, applied to law school, was admitted to the Duke Law School, graduated in 1973 from Duke, then served as a law clerk, first on the Federal Court of Appeals, then on the Supreme Court of the United States, was in private practice in Los Angeles first, and then in Washington, D.C., and then in 1981... I was invited by one of my law partners, I'd just become a partner in the firm, to join the Justice Department in the Reagan administration as Chief of Staff to the Attorney General, William French Smith. Then I served on the Court of Appeals, was appointed by President Reagan in 1983, and served in that capacity until 1989 when President Bush, through Attorney General Dick Thornburgh, asked me to become the Solicitor General of the United States back in the Justice Department, and then did that throughout the Bush administration. And then on January 20th, 1993, when President Clinton was inaugurated, I left that office and returned to private law practice after those many years, and also began teaching part-time at New York University Law School, where I've taught now for this will be my 11th year, and also at George Mason Law School, which was the home, my home for preparing the book, First Among Equals. And then after my independent counsel experience, which began in 1994 and ended in late 1999, I returned to my law firm of Kirkland & Ellis, which I had joined in 1993, I should hasten to add, when I left the government. And I have been at Kirkland and Ellis, save for the leave of absence during part of my independent counsel tenure, for the last 10-plus years doing appellate litigation, appearing in various courts of appeals, occasionally the Supreme Court of the United States, where I argued this fall for a private client, and working on a variety of issues.
Right.
So I'm a lawyer in private practice and a part-time law school teacher.
Do you miss the limelight, so to speak, from your independent counsel experience and your other jobs?
None whatsoever.
None whatsoever. I didn't think you would.
When you left, I guess, the Republican regime, when the Democrats took over, Bill Clinton came in, you said it's when you took off. Was that by your choice or his choice?
Well, I would say it was mutual. I think it's so important for each president to have senior officers throughout the government, but especially an officer in the Justice Department whose job is to represent the United States, including obviously the administration and the Supreme Court of the United States, to have the person of the president's own choosing. So I made absolutely no effort to remain in office, and I don't think it would have been warmly received had I done so.
Let me ask you why, and I'm going to turn to the book. What prompted you to write this book?
I actually started the book when I left the Solicitor General's office in 1993, and then due to law practice and then the duties of the independent counsel, when that came in fairly short order, I set it aside. But the idea for the book came when I was serving as Solicitor General, arguing cases day in and day out in the Supreme Court, controversial cases, school prayer, abortion, flag burning, a whole variety of issues that were quite controversial, not just to lawyers, but to the American people more generally. And I simply was reminded, having served there as a law clerk for 2 years, years before, how important the work of the court is to the daily lives and liberties of the American people. While the court doesn't decide great issues of war and peace, Iraq, North Korea, and the like, it nonetheless authoritatively resolves so many questions that people really feel strongly about, with abortion and school prayer, now affirmative action in the University of Michigan just being obvious examples
right.
of the importance and relevance of the court's work. I wanted to make the very significant and substantive work of the court accessible and understandable to a general lay audience that wasn't so designed or geared toward or directed toward lawyers and law students,
right.
but rather for a broader audience, just to enhance the understanding of an institution that's so important, but I think is not well understood.
First Among Equals, is that the main thesis of your book, that the Supreme Court is first amongst the three branches of government?
Well, I think it's a unifying theme or thesis, but I would say that the book explores a variety of themes and principles that the court follows. For example, one principle that I spend a long time talking about in various settings is the equality principle, which unifies a good deal of the court's work, including very controversially in Bush versus Gore, the decision that in large measure resolved the presidential election of the year 2000. The unifying principle there was equality, how we treat voters.
Right.
And so I'm trying to understand the court's work as fully and as deeply as possible, and then convey the court's work in an accessible way to a lay audience.
Right. Now for our audience, just a couple of basic questions here. Can only a lawyer serve as a judge on the Supreme Court?
There's no requirement in law. So, in fact, Hugo Black, a great justice of the 20th century, said in an interview with CBS, Eric Severide, a renowned news person at the time, that he thought it would be a good idea for a non-lawyer to serve. That's never happened, but there is nothing in law that requires the appointment of a lawyer.
I see. And how does a Supreme Court judge become a Supreme Court judge?
The judge, to become a justice, must be, of course, nominated by the president. Historically, and then confirmed by the Senate, historically, presidents have nominated individuals from two broad categories. The first is people in active public life who actually held significant office, the Attorney General of the United States in several instances. Governor Earl Warren, also a Republican vice presidential candidate in 1948, being another. Senator Hugo Black, I could go on. The second category are judges, those who have not only practiced law, but who have actually gone on the bench, typically the federal bench, but at times, as was Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve on the court, from a state court, typically an appellate court. So it's sort of promoting from, as it were, the minor leagues to the big leagues. And one of the things that I point out in the book, especially the chapter on the justices, is that modern-day presidents of both Democratic and Republican parties have seen fit to draw from Category 2 really quite exclusively. There's been no a real break and no return to the historic pattern of presidents looking to, say, Governor Earl Warren, Senator Hugo Black, and so forth. There's nothing to say that that tradition might not be restored, but for the last 30 years, the justices, without exception, have come from sitting members of either the federal judiciary or, in Justice O'Connor's instance, a state appellate court.
And do you think that's a good thing?
I think it is. I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with the prior tradition, but I think that the result is, and this does convey my own view of the role of the court, is that the court in the last certainly 15 years or so under Chief Justice Rehnquist has been a very lawyerly court that is quite prudent. I think it's quite cautious. I think it tends to be very careful about the assertion of judicial power and seeking to make sure that representative institutions are able to fashion social policy, economic policy, the principle of judicial restraint. And that happens to be my view as to the better, more appropriate, and enduring role of the court.
The appointment process seems to be quite difficult. How many, well, this is probably a difficult question. On average, like Clarence Thomas, what he went through, the approval process, how many people get rejected before one gets approved on average?
Actually, the averages are pretty good in terms of presidents being able to successfully secure the confirmation of their nominees. But and Justice Thomas is an example of that. But look to the immediate prior example of Justice Scalia. Or I guess actually it's Justice Kennedy, and then before that Justice Scalia. Both Justices Scalia and Kennedy were confirmed, I believe, unanimously or virtually unanimously. Every now and then you'll have a divided vote. The elevation of Chief Justice Rehnquist resulted in, I don't know, some considerable number of no votes. But still in all, he was confirmed. But you're quite right. There are times when the president finds himself unsuccessful. President Nixon was unsuccessful in his first two nominees for a particular vacancy that was eventually filled by Justice Harry Blackmun, now deceased, in following the so-called Southern strategy that's gotten a lot of attention of late in light of the Trent Lott situation. And then, pardon me, President Reagan was stymied, as is now famously recalled, with the nomination first of Judge Robert Bork. That was unsuccessful. Then the nomination of sitting Judge Douglas Ginsburg, now the Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And that was soon aborted. as a result of revelations of certain personal kinds of activities when he, Judge Ginsburg, was on the Harvard Law faculty. And so Justice Anthony Kennedy was the third choice for that particular seat. So sometimes that happens, but overwhelmingly the president gets his way, as we saw with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Stephen Breyer. They were overwhelmingly, I think again unanimously perhaps, confirmed by the Senate after a relatively non-controversial set of confirmation hearings.
Real quickly, do you think that it is appropriate for members of the Senate to apply a litmus test of sorts for potential Supreme Court justices? For example, do you think it's appropriate for a senator to vote against a potential candidate because the justice under consideration may have voted against abortion in a case, perhaps in his or her state?
I don't. It's a political decision. There's nothing in the Constitution that forbids a senator from following his or her own predilections and philosophies in this regard. But I think it's an intrusion into the independence of the judiciary to ask someone, how would you vote, or we see you voted in a particular way here in connection with a particular matter where reasonable minds could in fact differ, but because we feel so strongly about this particular issue, say abortion, we're going to vote a particular way. I think it's divisive for the country. I think it is very inimical to the independence of the judiciary, and I wish we would all rise up in righteous indignation and say, let's return, pardon me, to an inquiry as to the competency of the individual, the integrity of the individual, the experience of the individual,
right,
but not, in fact, try to apply this kind of philosophical or case-specific litmus test. But
the liberals will never let that happen, though.
Well, it's unfortunate because it wasn't so long ago, in connection with the confirmation process of Sandra Day O'Connor, that the then chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Joseph Biden, railed against the idea of a litmus test. There was the shoe was on the other foot, with two conservative Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee probing very assiduously into whether Justice O'Connor was sufficiently pro-life. There was a very strong outcry to the effect that you should not be intruding into this area. This is inappropriate. This is improper. But we have moved in the last generation to the point where a litmus test is fully and freely applied, and I just think it's unfortunate.
Right. Ken, you mentioned liberal, or Jack, you mentioned liberal.
Right.
I wanted to get into the liberal-conservative labels here because it seems like we can separate judges into those two camps, liberals and conservatives. And conservatives are known to interpret law, and liberals supposedly make law, which theoretically they're not supposed to do. Can you just flesh that out for us really quickly? What do we mean by conservatives interpreting and liberals making law?
Yes. I think the idea of a conservative interpretation is that the words, the text, the structure of the document, the Constitution, count for much. They are authoritative and they are binding. And that unless someone can point to a textual, structural basis for a particular proposed right, let us say, then the judiciary should be quite reluctant to step in and constitutionalize an area. Let's just take a quick example of physician-assisted suicide, Jack Kevorkian.
Right.
A more liberal interpretation would say there should be the right to individual autonomy and self-definition, and that right comes out of the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, the idea of not being deprived of liberty without due process of law, and that the judiciary should, in fact, interpret rights in such a way as to reflect the evolving values of society, and to impose then its vision of those rights, even in the face of considered legislative judgments to the contrary. A conservative, in contrast, would say, you know, whatever we might think individually as to individual autonomy should a person have the right to take his or her life collaboratively with a physician who's attending. Whatever our own personal views, we just don't see it in the Constitution. That's an issue that should be hammered out in the process of shaping public policy through debate, representative democracy, initiatives, referenda, and that sort of thing. And the judiciary should have a very limited role in that kind of process. That's, I think, an example of the division between the, quote, liberal and the, quote, conservative approach to constitutional interpretation, at least in a particular arena.
And which way, if any, is the Supreme Court leaning right now?
I would say it leans in the conservative direction. There are exceptions. There are exceptions that immediately spring to mind in a variety of arenas, but overall, it's not monochromatic. It's not just marching down one path to the exclusion of another. This is very nuanced, and so you have to almost look case by case. But overall, a pattern emerges, a pattern of considerable caution and prudence in terms of fashioning new rights, and frankly taking, I think, the text of the Constitution quite seriously, including, and when I say the Constitution, I obviously mean the amendments to the Constitution, including the Bill of Rights, and of course part of the original 10 amendments is the 10th Amendment protecting the rights of the states.
Right.
Now, with President Bush being a conservative, are there any judges looking at retiring at this point and knowing to be refilled with a conservative person?
Well, the rumors are abounding in Washington, and you've probably seen press reports to the effect that Chief Justice Rehnquist may be considering retirement. He, of course, hasn't made any announcements, and to my knowledge has not given any even informal indication to the White House or otherwise that he's intending to step down. But Chief Justice Rehnquist is a logical candidate for retirement, given his many years of service, his age. He's in his mid-70s. He's been on the court for now over 30 years.
Wow.
So that's a very substantial length of service. He has not been in the best of health, had a few health setbacks along the way. Nothing life-threatening as far as we know.
Mm-hmm.
Justice O'Connor, too, has served now for over 20 years, and she is in her 70s. And so both those justices are viewed as Republican appointees who might very well step down in a Republican administration, and now especially in light of the November elections with the Republican Senate, it stands to reason that they would seriously consider that. Now, who would be a candidate to replace one or both of these justices? Fourth Circuit, based in Richmond, judges are frequently mentioned. First, Chief Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, very distinguished Chief Judge, rich experience, very respected, much admired judge of the Fourth Circuit. Judge Michael Luttig, based in Northern Virginia, also very deeply respected, former law clerk for Chief Justice Berger and Justice Scalia, and a very distinguished judge. Their names are very frequently mentioned. I would also very briefly mention that if the Chief Justice steps down, then a very logical candidate for elevation would be a sitting member of the court, just as then Justice Rehnquist was elevated to become the Chief Justice of the United States when Chief Justice Warren Burger, his predecessor, stepped down. Then Governor Bush, candidate now President Bush, said during the 2000 campaign that the two sitting justices whom he admired most in terms of their judicial philosophy were Justices Scalia and Thomas. So one would have to look to the two of them. And the final point I would make is then if the president were interested in pursuing, let us call it an impact appointment, more for political consideration, someone who he thought was qualified, but also just looking to reshape the court from a more political perspective, then frequently mentioned is the White House counsel, Judge Gonzalez, Alberto Gonzalez, who, of course, is well-known to the president, is a friend of the president. The president appointed him when he was serving as governor to the Texas Supreme Court. He was his general counsel, and is a wonderful American success story, humble roots, Harvard Law School, partnership in a leading law firm in Houston, and very close to the president. So I would say we would keep an eye on him. And I guess I said finally, let me add one thing. we sometimes, I find, overlook a very logical breeding ground, so to speak, grooming ground, I should say, for the Supreme Court, and that is the Justice Department. While, again, these aren't individuals who've been serving on the court, nonetheless, people who've been serving as senior law officers in the Justice Department are usually considered quite seriously for elevation or appointment to the Supreme Court.
Right.
The Solicitor General of Thurgood Marshall was the last one to go on. And I would point to Larry Thompson, who's the Deputy Attorney General, who's African-American, very deeply respected, much admired individual who served with great distinction as United States Attorney in Atlanta.
Ken, what about yourself?
Well, I think that might be a little controversial, but I think the ratings for the confirmation hearings would be pretty high.
I think you're right. Why don't we move to some of the hot-button issues that you discuss in your book? Why don't we start off, Jack, you were really interested in the issue of religion.
It's just something that baffles me is that religion has been part of our country since the Constitution, well, before the Constitution was ever written, and continue to be with our forefathers. And why are the courts so dead set on removing religion from any form from schools and government, except for the fact that you get sworn in on a Bible?
Well, I think it's an interesting observation. We have moved, I think, to greater flexibility in permitting these expressions of our religious traditions, our heritage, our background in the public square. I quite agree. The courts were for some time showing a good deal of hostility, and sometimes that's still evident, to any expression of religious faith in the public square. But I think that after the pendulum swung a little bit far in the direction of hostility toward religion, I think it's coming back. It's not exactly where I would want it, and I discuss this in the book, but very briefly, I think what the court at its best, or the federal courts more generally, should be trying to do is to achieve that important respect. It's not just a balance, but it's a respect for freedom of conscience on the one hand, so that individuals are free from coercion and their consciences are protected, so they're not asked to engage, much less required to engage in religious exercises or acknowledgments with which they disagree. But at the same time, and herein lies, I think, the trend toward greater flexibility, there is, nonetheless, the irrefutable fact that we are, as Justice William O. Douglas put it during the Warren Court, in writing for the Warren Court in a particular case, wrote, "We are a religious people whose institutions presuppose the existence of a supreme being." You say, well, where does that come from? Well, you only have to go to the opening words of the Declaration of Independence, that rights come from God, from the Creator. That's a founding document of the country. Now, you shouldn't be required, let's say someone is a non-believer, someone's an atheist or an agnostic, they should not be required to recite the Declaration of Independence. So, too, someone should not be required to recite, against their will, the Pledge of Allegiance. But it does not mean, while protecting that individual's conscience, that individual's freedom of mind, that society as a whole, or the class, should not be able to engage in the activity of reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. That's
right,
where the court, I think, out in San Francisco, went much too far in going beyond protecting individual conscience and moving to, I think, a very, very unfortunate situation of trying to eradicate something that's very, very dear to us and that's part of our history and tradition.
Exactly. You can't even walk past the Ten Commandments in the hallway of a government building without someone taking offense to it, or a person in the world taking offense to it.
Well, and all around us, and what I like to say to my friends, and I really mean this, I'm not saying it pejoratively or tongue-in-cheek to the ACLU, is that, you know, I think with all due respect, those who are seeking to preserve maximum freedom of conscience, and I respect that, I really do, nonetheless are very selective. They have selective targets, and there's a certain almost idiosyncratic, unpredictable quality to their targets. And the example, and I maybe shouldn't even mention it because it's so special to me, because I love jogging on the Mall in Washington, D.C., and one of my favorite spots is the Lincoln Memorial. Well, there, carved in stone, literally, in the Lincoln Memorial is the Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural. The second inaugural address of Mr. Lincoln refers to Almighty God 11 times. It's the shortest inauguration speech in history. And yet it is suffused with its quotations from Scripture, references to Almighty God, the judgment of God on the people by virtue of slavery, and like it is virtually a sermon. Well, are we going to get the sandblaster out and say, oh, we can't do that because, you know, our atheist friends, our unbelieving friends are offended by that?
Right.
Well, my response is, we're not requiring you to recite it, but it exists. It is a fact. Lincoln gave that address, and that address is part of our history and part of our tradition.
It's our heritage.
It's part of our heritage, and we should be able to read it and savor it in the public schools without saying, now, does everybody believe in God? That's the line. And I think it's a common sense line, and that we should, in fact, again, be respectful of conscience, those who do not want to participate, but at the same time be respectful of our heritage.
Right. School vouchers, do you think the court, wasn't it a 5-4 decision in favor of that Cleveland program?
That's exactly right, and I'm a full disclosure, I've served here in my law firm as outside counsel to the state of Ohio and to the Attorney General of Ohio, Betty Montgomery, and so I was personally involved in that case. But stepping out and then from the viewpoint of an observer of the Constitution and an observer of the court, a student of the Constitution, I think the court got it exactly right. And why? Yes, funds are going to religiously affiliated schools, deeply Catholic schools, even an Islamic school receives the benefits of this program. But there are two key elements. The first is, this is a program of the private choice of parents who are choosing what is right educationally as their lights lead them for their child. And the second is, this is an entirely voluntary program in Ohio that responded to the profound failure and the tragic failure of the public school system in Cleveland. That is, the Ohio General Assembly, in fashioning this program, was looking at an educational crisis and saying, we want to use every reasonable asset available, every classroom seat we should use that's available, and empowering people, not requiring them. But that brings me back to that first point, which I think is so important, a system of true private choice. Just as we've had the GI Bill, can you imagine someone saying, oh, you can't go to the University of Richmond on the GI Bill because it's affiliated with the Baptist community, or, you know, Notre Dame or Yeshiva. It would be astonishing, and no one seriously challenges the ability of, you know, Congress to fashion such programs, and I think the same principle applies.
Sometimes I wonder if the Republicans didn't come out just firmly against vouchers, that the Democrats would say, vouchers are the only way to go, and we get it passed.
Well, I think the politics of vouchers are such that that will not happen just because the teachers' union is so powerful as a political force in this country and is so adamantly and ardently set against school choice that I just don't think we will see that happen. But on the other hand, there's some very brave and good people in the Democratic Party, like the mayor of Milwaukee, who views himself as a progressive. That's what he calls himself. I think a Republican would probably refer to him as a liberal Democrat, who's been at the forefront of saying school choice is right for us here in Milwaukee for these inner-city children. And by the way, one of the things that's happened in Milwaukee, which was the first city to have this kind of program to permit inner-city children to go to parochial schools with a state-paid voucher, is that the public schools of Milwaukee have gotten better. Why? Competition. Why is it that we have in the United States the best, most envied higher education system in the world? And then why is it that across America our public schools have not been producing? They have not been
competition.
Achieved?
Competition, Kevin.
Competition.
Right.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. Competition makes the product better. We don't have it in our secondary school system.
We so agree with that in every other part of life. You know, we get nervous when we hear about a monopoly. Well, then we've got to regulate the monopoly, lest we be charged monopoly prices. I mean, that's just basic common sense. You don't have to had a course in economics in high school, much less college, to understand these fundamental rudimentary facts of economic life, of free markets. We believe in the idea of free markets. The world now believes in free markets. I think Cuba and North Korea are the only countries that don't believe in free markets.
We just have a couple minutes left here. I want to hit a couple issues real fast, if we could.
Sure.
Affirmative action. Are you a believer that we should have a societal remedy, or do you believe in a more specific remedy? For example, if an institution is found to have discriminated on a systematic basis, perhaps have some sort of affirmative action program for that institution, but not have a presumption that we have societal discrimination.
Yes, it's a very difficult issue, but I have spent a fair amount of time thinking about it, and I talk about this in some detail in the book, and very briefly, I do think it's a very serious matter when one draws lines on the basis of race. I believe we are all a minority of one, and the Constitution, specifically through the 14th Amendment as well as the 5th Amendment, talks about each individual. Each of us is a minority of one. Now, what is to be done in terms of inclusion? I think there is every, and I'm a volunteer in the inner city. Our church is very active in the inner city of Washington. I think we do have, I believe, a moral, I have it as a faith-based obligation to reach out to those who don't have the same advantages as others. But I think we need to do that in a very careful way, in a way that's not divisive, but a way that just help individuals equip themselves and get the kind of training and background that they need in order to do well on the merits, and that we should proceed that way.
Okay, one last question.
Actually, I got some.
I had a Bush v. Gore question. But go ahead, Jack.
Well, no, go ahead and shoot with that first, because mine is not really related to this. It's more...
Well, my question is, some people ask me this question, Ken. They say, well, Gore got more votes than Bush did, and of course I talked about the Electoral College. But I still have people that come and tell me, why did the Supreme Court rule in favor of George Bush? And can you just... Tell our audience, why did the court rule in favor of Bush over Gore?
Yes. First, there was not simply a question of Florida state law, but a very important question under the Constitution, under Article 2 of the Constitution, that brought a federal constitutional issue to the Supreme Court for resolution. And on round one of Bush v. Gore, when they vacated the initial decision of the Florida Supreme Court, that decision was unanimous. All nine justices agreed that the Florida Supreme Court had failed in certain respects to address the federal constitutional questions that were involved. So when one says, oh, that was just a state law issue, the Supreme Court had no business doing this, they're mistaken. With all due respect to them, they're just mistaken, and a more careful and sober, dispassionate analysis would lead a fair-minded viewer or reader to the viewpoint that, yes, there is a federal constitutional question, so it's appropriate for the court to be involved.
Right.
In terms of its resolution on the merits, I believe the Supreme Court came to the view, and it's a sensible view, it's not the only view, that the Supreme Court of Florida had usurped its power. It had usurped the power specifically of the legislative branch. It was riding roughshod over the clearly established, they weren't crystal clear, but nonetheless, the clearly established procedures ordained by the Florida legislature, and that's what the federal constitution looks to, the manner set by the legislature, not by the judiciary. And finally, and on this, seven justices agreed. They didn't agree on the bottom line. Only five did. But seven agreed that there was a very serious issue with respect to equality and the lack of equality and regularity in the way that the votes were being counted in the recounting process, that it had become a crazy quilt, messed up system, and that the equality principle that I talk about in the book was being violated. I think it's a reasonable, more justifiable than not decision, but I understand reasonable minds can differ. But it certainly was not a usurpation of power by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Right.
Okay, I got a couple quick questions for you. Prior to the Whitewater investigation and impeachment, all that kind of stuff, the Democrats and the Clintons specifically talked about how straightforward, honest, basically raved about you as a person. And then, obviously, they did a lot of, let's try to think of a nice way of putting it. Vilified you, basically. And is there any animosity still there, or how do you feel about what happened?
Well, I try, and this is from both a faith perspective as well as just a getting on in life perspective, to really use Lincoln as an example of his second inaugural, with malice toward none and charity toward all. It was a difficult time for the country. Feelings ran very high. People of very goodwill felt that the president should not have been impeached, that this was entirely and an overly intrusive, overly expensive investigation. I respectfully disagree with that. It certainly was unfortunate that the facts were as the facts were. But I understand that, and that people of goodwill can feel very strongly about it. But the key thing that I would just leave people with is that my colleagues and I, in the Independent Counsel's office, always were conducting ourselves in what we thought was an upright, honest manner with integrity, and that we were carrying on the work that was actually assigned to us by the Attorney General of the United States. So when people, and I think this is really the bottom line complaint, say this should never have been investigated, namely the relationship and his activity and the Jones deposition and all the rest, I simply remind them, or inform them, as the case may be, that the decision to investigate was made by the Attorney General of the United States, Janet Reno.
That is amazing in itself. One last question for you before we just tell people where they can find your book and all. I read the reviews online, what people said about your book, and with the exception of some extreme liberals, it's just without any reason, basically saying you didn't know what you're talking about, but couldn't back it up with anything. There were a few of those, you know, like I said, extreme people. But the biggest thing I noticed, a lot of people purchased the book with hopes to find out more about Monica Lewinsky and things that happened. Do you plan on writing anything about that in the future?
I am very pleased to say I have absolutely no plans whatever to write such a book. Notice the I hope not inartful or unartful formulation. I have no plans. That is an honest and transparent statement. But you know, other books are coming out about that era, and frankly, I have it under advisement as to whether I would even seriously consider taking on one. But I will say there's one huge reason that I have not eagerly sought it, and that is the whole exercise of 1998-99 was so singularly unpleasant for the country and for my family and me at a very personal level that it's just not pleasant to dwell on those issues.
Right. I was just curious. So this book is fairly new in the marketplace, and where can they find it?
They can find it in their favorite bookstore. It is published by Warner Books. It's called First Among Equals.
Mm-hmm.
They can also get it online at Amazon.com. They'll get it to you the next day. And BarnesandNoble.com and Borders.com.
Hmm. Right.
Everywhere. Ken, thank you very much for joining us on the book show.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it, and good luck with everything.
Thanks so much. I appreciate your time, and it's good to talk to you.
All right. Take care, Ken.
Bye.
Very much. Ken, thanks for joining us on the book show.
Yes, let us know when your next book's out.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Heather Hughes, senior editor of Pages Magazine, the magazine for people who love books, and one of the sponsors of the book show. This is Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books. We'll be right back. Do you like to write? If so, Writer's Digest, the world's leading magazine for writers, is for you. Since 1920, Writer's Digest has provided expert writing instruction, inspiration, and up-to-date marketing information. Each month, readers turn to Writer's Digest to discover technique columns geared toward specific genres, including screenwriting, fiction, nonfiction, children's books, and more. Publishing information, including how to write solid cover and query letters that catch the interest of agents and editors. Tips and tricks for overcoming writer's block. Career opportunities. Interviews with best-selling authors, tools of the trade, including the latest information on writing software and hardware, legal advice for writers, and more. Log on to www.writersdigest.com/thebookshow and ask for your two free issues. You'll see why more than 200,000 writers rely on Writer's Digest every month to learn the secrets of getting their words polished, published, and paid for.
Do you want thousands of books at your fingertips? If so, go to enovel.com. At eNovel.com, you'll find thousands of e-books, print books, and audiobooks to browse and buy. eNovel.com, the world's biggest e-book site, sells books from big-name authors and hot new rising stars. And if you're a promising writer, eNovel might publish your book, too. So go to www.enovel.com to shop for great e-books, print books, and audiobooks, or to publish your own book today.